Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Christy Vogler.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Colin McCormick.
And we also have our very special guest once again, Hannah Bazinaw. Round of applause. Yeah! Oh, Hannah. And today, we're revisiting Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, a 2010 American action fantasy film directed by Chris Columbus and written by Craig Titley. Ooh, I hope got that right. And so, you guys, one of many sound clips I have for you today, here's the first.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So, yeah, you guys, we have been doing a lot of Percy Jackson. We all just wrapped up looking at the most recent series, and we'll start off with, do you guys dig the movie once we revisit it? And I think we'll go to our guest, Hannah, for the first response. So, Hannah, what do you think?
Okay, well, it will always hold a special place in my heart because I did see the movie before I read the books. The movie was what, like, got my attention. I don't dig it. It's worse than I remembered it to be. Nostalgia made it better, honestly.
Yeah. Some movies, sometimes it's better not to rewatch because it's like, it lives better as a memory. And then you go back. Like, I think for me, that's like Meet the Parents. Like in my memory, that's a funny movie. But I bet if I rewatched it, my opinion of it would change a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. All right, Colin, are you in the camp with Hannah?
Yeah, this movie's best. It should have swept at the Oscars in 2010. This movie's fucking amazing. Full send all the way. No, this movie is – I don't think my opinion has changed too much. My compass hasn't wavered. I came to one or two new realizations. But in general, this movie is – I think the thesis is this movie came at an interesting point in – studios searching for the next big fantasy series. Mm-hmm. And it sort of felt that it could get, my vibe is that it felt like it could get away with a very paint by numbers approach to these kinds of movies. And that turned out to not be the case. It felt very surface level and very superficial in its approach, both to the source material and just film generally.
All right. All right. Lej.
I hate this movie. I hate it so much. I think my opinion of it has worsened, actually, upon a rewatch. I was thinking, like,
this
as
like
I was watching
time?
It. Yes, it's. I'm like, why have I watched this movie so many times?
I've watched this movie more times than movies I like.
Right? Oh, my God. And no, I was watching it over lunch today, and I was just like, I'm bored. And what I came to this realization that I just have lost all patience for this story, for this type of movie, for this movie specifically. Like, I was just like, I've had it up to here. And I was like, nope, I don't like it. It has no redeeming qualities for me. I hate it so much.
Womp womp.
Yeah.
Here to be the devil.
Strong endorsement from Elijah Fleming.
Yep, right. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, Elijah is our usual kind of like, you're the anchor
downer?
Of these movies. Yeah, the downer of these movies every time. And
I like anchor. That's less of
anchor,
a
anchor, right? I thought that was a good
one.
All
right.
In the race, the anchor is your fastest runner you put at the end.
It's true. That's true.
Very true.
I will take the kind phrasing of this. Yeah. Yes, the anchor.
But, you guys, I hate to break it to you. I found this delightful to watch.
Get out.
Interesting.
Because it's what
we call dialectic in the biz.
It was, you guys, you know what this was for me? Is like having so closely dissected the series and learning so much from Hannah and my other students about the original series. This was the camp version of Percy Jackson. And I needed some camp. Exactly. And it's right,
I assume you mean camp figuratively, because there is also a lot of camp in this movie.
Yes. Yes.
One of the realizations that I had today is like, again, you know, thinking about this movie feels like it's very much trying to kind of be the next Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or whatever the big, you know, sci-fi fantasy franchises of the time. And it kind of falls apart because when I think about it for more than a few seconds, it becomes a little weird because like in Harry Potter, they go to a school and they have like an academic calendar and presumably they like learn things and have a major and they go get jobs. But like this is a military training camp.
Yeah.
These kids are like in boot camp. I mean, and I also say kids. They're mostly, they seem to mostly be grown adults slash Abercrombie and Fitch models, but.
Yep.
And they're training to be quote unquote warriors and future leaders, which is like, oh my God, they're training like the, a cell, like a, what's it
sleeper
called?
Sleeper
like
cell.
Sleepers. This is like a sleeper cell. They're training the next like Manchurian candidates. They're going to infiltrate all the highest levels of government and politics and business. And like, they're all going to take over the world. Like, this is some Illuminati shit, but.
Well, according to Rick, World War II was started between like Sons of Zeus and Sons of Hades.
Yeah, right. Deep. This is the deep state we're watching. Yeah. And they're going to their like paramilitary training camp where everybody has to wear jeans.
Okay. I was going to say, I think the reason that I enjoyed this is because after dissecting every episode of the Disney series and coming away very frustrated that in some ways they were trying to tell a more serious version of it, but then they have it set with younger kids that it removed some of the joy in some ways. And there was an article in The Atlantic, so I'm going to quote from that really quick because it really did sum it up for me really well, is that the show is an overcorrection. It was so concerned with faithfulness to the books that it left little room for wonder. The show's overexplanation, by contrast, turns colorful characters into mouthpieces for exposition and compelling plots in excuses to move from point A to point B. And I think that's, you know, that was the problem you guys highlighted when the first time when you looked at the movie. It was like, there's so many plot holes that make no sense. That the series did a really good job with all of that exposition.
Sure.
That movie was really made for people who had read the books and were well-versed in the books.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have that context and you're okay with it not being a perfect replica of the books, it's almost really enjoyable because you have the information you need for it to function and you can just kind of enjoy the zaniness of like certain lines like this.
There's nowhere safe on heaven and earth for him now. Percy, take this to defend yourself. It's a powerful weapon. Guard it well. Only use it in times of severe distress.
This is a pen. This is a pen.
And I thought, like, that was what's good about the movie. It's like, it had so many lines that was really just bringing in, like, here's a kid. And, like, all of these things, these really weird things are happening around him. It's like, you're giving me a pen? What? And I found that very enjoyable. I don't know what to say.
This is a pin is, like, a very iconic line amongst fans. And for a really long time, I didn't even realize it doesn't come from the book. Like, that's how iconic and beloved it is. The movie had, like, a couple good things going for it. One of them was Sean Bean. Love you. Love you, baby.
Yeah. Also, Varanus. Like, Poseidon is played by Lucius, by the same actor as Lucius Varanus of Rome, which
Kevin McKidd.
Yep.
Sorry. Keep going, Hannah.
I think, like, the first part, up until they get to camp, is actually really good. It felt more realistically New York to me. More realistically, like big city, much grimier. Yeah. I found Gabe's his like pronounced Italian accent very funny.
Well, that's just Joe Pantoliano just doing his thing, who has made a career of his life of just being like a professional scumbag. That is his whole like, you know, cipher in the Matrix, but he's in Memento, and he's always like his real strength is just being like a real sleaze.
Well, and that was so. Of episode 8 and like of the series as a whole, that was honestly one of the most unnerving changes that Disney made was to Gabe's character, and that they made a domestic abuser funny. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
And what I loved about this Gabe's depiction is like he is a scumbag.
He's nasty.
Can tell he is physically abusive towards Percy and his mom. And you don't feel bad when, like, hubris gets him at the end and he gets turned into a statue by Medusa. They did not in any way use him for comedic relief, which I actually really appreciate that from the movie and really detest that they did in the series.
I have another question, which is in the scene I noticed this viewing is in the shot where he shows up on the television you know, giving his statement about Percy's a terrorist or whatever. His last name is Ugliano. Ugliano is his name. Is that that's he's Gabe Ugliano?
Yeah. Yeah, he is Gabe Ugliano.
I guess, yeah, Ugliano if we're being generous, but
I feel like I know Elijah felt differently, that you said you thought even worse of the movie after watching this. But I actually feel like the movie and what Hannah said about, like, this is a pen being a line that's not even from the book. I feel like this is going to turn the movies into camp.
Okay, but if we want camp, there's the Broadway musical. The critically acclaimed Broadway musical where Annabeth is like, oh my God, that's Tartarus. And Percy goes, the fish sauce?
Okay, I mean, yes, that's delightful. And like, if we're going full camp, I would have wanted more. Like, yeah. I feel like it's not, if it's going that direction, like, everybody needs to be hamming it up like Medusa. Because I feel like she knew what kind of movie she was in.
Ooh, Miss Thurman.
Yes.
Are you right? Are you
and,
ready?
Like, she was having fun with it.
Son of Poseidon, I used to date your daddy.
There you go.
I just hate it so much. It's so dumb. I can't.
Well, okay. So Rick Riordan famously hates the movies. And at one point on his blog, he released some emails that were sent in March of 2009 to like the directors and the writers when he was like writing the script. When they were writing the script and they sent it to him for notes. Here are some of my favorites. Having said that, here's the bad news. The script as a whole is terrible. I don't simply mean that it deviates from the book, though certainly it does. Fans of the book will be angry and disappointed. They will leave the theater in droves and generate horrible word of mouth. This is an absolute given if the script goes forward as it stands now. But the bigger problem is that even if you pretend the books don't exist, the script doesn't work as a story on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of my thought as I was watching, because I'm thinking as I am watching this movie, right? It's 2010. We're casting our net out for, I guess, wait, who produced this? Was it Disney originally or did Disney acquire the
no, 20th Disney Century
Fox? Yeah. So 20th Century Fox, they're casting their net out for the next Harry Potter, the next Lord of the Rings. There are some failed attempts, right? There's the Golden Compass movies. There's the Narnia series that never really gets off the ground.
Yep.
And it kind of feels like there's a, almost like a laziness to the whole approach.
Yes.
And they tap Christopher Columbus, right, who's of Home Alone and Mrs. Doubtfire fame. He had done the first two Harry Potter movies.
Yep.
And it felt like a, just a very, like, if we just, you know, check all of the right boxes and we just have, like, a serviceable movie, you know, Christopher Columbus, say what you will about him as a director and his directing style, but he produces serviceable movies. And then it's just like, so we don't even need to like think too hard about the plot, like the, turning the whole adventure into the, we got it. We get the map. We get a map that shows us where to go. We go to the X, Y, and Z. We get pearls 1, 2, 3, you know, we get, and that's, we get these action set pieces. And right. So long as we kind of do the bare minimum, this movie will make money. And I guess in some ways that they were right. The movie did make over $200 million. Yeah. $226 million. So.
Well, Rick did say, when I first read the script, I'll admit I was plunged into despair at how bad it was.
So dramatic.
If I were intentionally trying to sabotage this project, I doubt I could have done a better job than this script.
Yeah, and like the all the most of the dialogue gets reduced to these very either like very sort of ham-fisted jokes or tacked on exposition. Like at a certain point in the movie, Annabeth just becomes a exposition font. Yep. Where she's just like, that's the this of this, they are do this of this, right? They're like, this is the lair of the lotus eaters, they've been trapping people for centuries. Like she's like reading it off a cue card.
After the fact they've been trapped there for
yes, and this is like, oh right, yes, explain, right? It is like the whole the script of the movie reads much the same as a Wikipedia plot summary of the movie.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. I will say they wasted their cast. It was a good cast.
I know, gosh.
I disagree. Yeah.
Well,
you don't think
I'm in love with Alexandra Daddario, so.
I mean,
I'm biased.
Yes. She's absolutely gorgeous. She should not have been Annabeth. That's what I'm saying. I love her. Not in this movie. It's just, I don't know. I did not like her as Annabeth. She had no character at all. She was like a flat piece of white paper.
They didn't give her anything. They didn't even give her a flipping hair tie when she's doing all that sword play at the beginning and the end of the movie. Okay. That was
the costuming and sets. I have a whole thing about that we need to talk about again because I've already talked about it once. But but I guess we're kind of also dancing around the fact that if Alessandra Daddario is the correct or incorrect choice for the cast, is the fact of the matter is all of these people they're supposed to be 17, so they're already aged up in the script. And Logan Lerman, I think at the time, is like 20 or 21 or something like that.
No, you said he was like 18 at the time of the shooting in the original. Maybe.
He was born in 1992. I looked this up. And I think Alessandra Daddario is a couple years older. And Brandi T. Jackson's the oldest of the three.
Yeah.
And he's like closing in on 30. And so you have, 20-year-olds playing 17-year-olds in a story that was written for 14-year-olds or written as 14-year-olds.
Yeah, because it was not written for middle schoolers. This movie was not made for middle schoolers.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we got to the aging up choice is a choice, right? And I don't know. Yeah. I don't know actually if there was a particular reason for it, if it was just to avoid.
It's as child actors can't work as long on screen.
Yeah.
There's that. But I do remember, I think it was in one of Rick Riordan's responses to the movie, is that was one of the choices that really, really upset him because it doesn't give the characters room to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was his whole, shtick about his series is that it starts off, they're these younger characters and they move through the world and they get more complex in a similar to Harry Potter kind of way. Where the younger books are maybe a little bit less terrifying and as they go on, things get more serious. And if you're already starting from a point where the simplest supposedly plot is already aged up, it's something isn't right. It feels weird. And I don't like that they aged up the characters. I think they were going for trying to get an older audience, and I don't think it worked out.
I think Hannah's point is right, is that labor-wise, it's a lot easier to have older actors to work with. But also, if we think about when the books released versus when the movie came out, the initial fans would have been high school, college at that point. And so would have spoken to they would have.
They're trying to get ahead of the ball.
Yeah,
so to speak.
They catered to the the original audience instead of.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I honestly don't think they cared about the audience at all. I think besides the labor thing, the next biggest driving issue is they wanted to create a new heartthrob.
Wanted
Logan Lerman to be it, which in the first movie he kind of is.
I was also going to say, I love the beginning of the movie when they're walking through the high school hall and Grover makes that side comment, this ain't no high school musical. It's that was an exact comment over the fact that Lerman looked like a knockoff Zac Efron, and not knockoff in a bad way, just a counterpart Zac Efron. If you
had Zac Efron at home.
Yes, he has a little bit of Great Value brand. In that, the hair is not doing him any favors, I think, in that department.
No. Mm.
Good and Gather, Zac Efron.
Yeah. It does. Yeah, it feels like they were trying to position him and also Daddario as these are the next big young actors, tent poles, build a franchise around them, right? Invest here. Yeah. And it didn't pay out. But I mean, these are just the sometimes it's somebody's calling, somebody tries to call their shot and then the shot misses.
And I think that was part of the other reason that I was enjoying this movie after coming out of watching the series so closely was the frustration of writing to catering to a middle school audience where you bring up adult topics, but then but you're not willing to delve deeply into them. Versus this one is let's do sexual innuendo. Let's do drugs. Let's do.
Movie's very clear that Grover, right? That's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. Which is appropriate for Sator, honestly. I was actually disturbed that Grover was not wearing shorts over
I was going to say, right? He's just freeballing the whole time, right?
The whole time. Dancing on that stage in Vegas.
Yeah.
Like Winnie the Pooh. No pants.
Yeah, he's Donald Ducking it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Yep. And so it's like you've got that going on. You have the depiction of Gabe that I really appreciated. And then I'm sure we're going to spend some time on the underworld because you guys had a lot to say about it last time. And there's things to say about it. But
I don't even remember what I said.
I remember a little
bit. Well, it's Christian hell. And
yeah.
As the Greek underworld. So that's problematic in its certain ways. But what I really appreciated was this take on Persephone.
He won't remember a thing.
Why'd you do that?
Because he's cruel and abusive. The only thing I look forward to is my allotted time away from this hellhole. A war of the gods would put an end to that. And I'd be alone with only him.
And I kind of liked that because, you know, there's so much Persephone, Hades romance happening right now that, like, it was almost refreshing to have someone being like, the girl was abducted. She doesn't like it, like, going back to the original storyline of, like, this was all against her own choice. And then all of a sudden inserting a Persephone, because that's very much what the movie did. It wasn't in the books. Inserting Persephone and calling out, he's abusive. He sucks. I don't want to be with him. I don't want to be stuck with him any more than I have to be. And that was, again, refreshing because the domestic violence in the series was talked around so much. That was so frustrating that it was really nice to have it just be like spoken out loud in this movie, being like, yeah, this sucks.
I think that was like made before the rise of dark romance really just like hit the internet. Now we've got books like Haunting Adeline and Mafia Romance and the TikTokification of books and how they're kind of produced like fast fashion now in some ways. Something that bothers me a lot that wasn't really fixed in the series either. Well, it was kind of fixed a little bit. I just want to see mobility aids normalized and even be cool. I liked that Grover fucked Gabe up with his crutches, but you know what? It's kind of meh and questionable that you have these characters that are like, they're supposed to be like physically, visibly, they have visible disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, psych, they're actually just like able-bodied mythical creatures. There's no disabilities here.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a problem with the film. And I think some of the initial books was like, it was very ableist. Yeah. And I know in the series, like one change that they did make was giving Chiron a mechanical leg, which is hard to notice when you watch it in the first episode. But
I did not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rorden, if you hadn't pointed that out, I wouldn't have noticed. So is it meaningful representation if it's not actually like, if there's no attention drawn to it?
Yeah.
It's like the exclusively gay moment in the live action Beauty and the Beast.
Yes. Yeah.
That's exactly 2 seconds that can be edited out when you have to screen it in China.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's what was something really interesting about, because I think we should talk about some of the drastic changes that happened from the books and series to this movie, because there are some, like, Clarice is gone.
Yeah.
You go to the Nashville Parthenon instead of the Arch in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some extensive changes. But I also liked that the movie in some way was willing to, like, yeah, we can drastically change this part of the story and it will still fit into the narrative overall. Like, all of our kids are old enough to drive. So it's a road trip.
Yeah.
Now, instead of trying to figure out like how to get on a train or something like that. And I thought that was interesting because it's like, yeah, it does show that you can deviate from the books, especially when there were elements of the books that you knew were problematic and that you could, after a decade, be like, yeah, that was problematic and we have learned a lot since then and I am more than willing to change it now. But that's hard to do as a creator, I imagine.
So I was just thinking, to circle back to the point you were making about like specifically disability rep, and this, I think not just this movie, but the series generally plays a little bit into the like disability as super ability trope, right? Where it's like, you know, you're not you're not dyslexic. You are a superhuman demigod, right? You can read ancient Greek. You're hyperactive because your battle reflexes are kicking in, or whatever it is, right? And that is, I mean, it's a, I mean, it's a trope with sort of a long pedigree, right? I think it goes all, I mean, at least like to Daredevil, right? Who was probably, mm-hmm. I think, created in the 60s or 70s. And, but it's one where it's like, is that really disability rep, or is it like, I don't know.
I don't know. I have complicated feelings on it. I don't think that ADHD and dyslexia, I don't have a problem with those, because you see that like so scarcely amongst protagonists, and it's not even something that's visible. So it's just like not even, they could have even put it in as an afterthought, but no one bothers to.
I think it is cool, and like the intention of, again, the audience. I think it's really important to keep in mind the audience for these books is like Rorden really wanted to make people with ADHD, dyslexia feel empowered, right? Like, yeah, it seems tropey here as critical adults saying that, but like kids aren't thinking that hard. They just want to see a representation and be like, yeah, I can do cool stuff with this. But I also was like, yeah, but the first time you show a kid ancient Greek and the letters don't unscramble for them, like that poor guy who got a tattoo that says derps.
Come back to the tattoo. we had a lot of text threads about this tattoo.
So yeah. Hannah, I don't know if you noticed the whole capture the flag. There's all the sons of Ares are like on Team Annabeth to capture the flag, and one of them is sporting an arm tattoo with four Greek letters on it. That's Delta Rho Pi Zeta, and like it visually looks like it's supposed to say Ares, but it quite literally reads derps.
Like, I can't stop giggling at it. It's just,
and also the fact that all the sons of Ares look like they're like at a CrossFit gym.
They look like football players in their jeans.
I can't get past the jeans thing, but
yeah, why are we running through the forest in jeans?
There is a shot when they're in the healing tent where somebody is putting a bandage over somebody's jeans. Everybody in the camp, without exception, actually, I guess excepting Grover and Chiron because they're just ass naked from the waist down. Everybody in that camp is wearing jeans, which is insane. That's not what you wear to summer camp, but whatever. I mean, maybe sometimes.
Because if you're horseback riding.
Some people prefer their little short shorts to go running.
But not gonna name names. when you're doing a calisthenics course, or one person was like doing the like rope gymnastics.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, oh, I love those courses. Yeah.
Don't you want maybe some leggings? Any kind of, you know, stretchy something that's going to let you move around? I don't know, man. Yeah. Well, if you're going to buy a bunch of jeans, like as the costume director, probably buy a bunch of Old Navy or Gap jeans to clothe these CrossFit models.
Who go to summer. These adults that go to summer camp.
Yeah.
Where they train to be in a secret army that's going to take over all the prominent positions in the world power. Right. Okay, cool.
Well, do we want to go through some of these drastic changes that the movie did? Because there's a few.
You go through the plot, even. Yeah.
Yeah. Plot.
Oh, I remember from the last time we talked about this, one of the things that just really stood out to me was how the plot is a video game. It is, you have the map that takes you to the one thing to find the other thing to get to the other thing. And it just, it's like you have to, you know, check these boxes and go in your little, you know, Zelda video game to talk to the right person to get the right jewel.
And even the sometimes the pearls themselves were a bit of an afterthought. Like when they're in the casino, they're trying to escape the casino, and he's like, "Oh wait, here's the." It felt like somebody in the writers' room was like, "Oh wait, they haven't gotten the pearl yet." And someone's like, "He sees it on the roulette's table and then grabs it."
Yeah, easy peasy. It's fine.
I was waiting for it to be thematic because the first pearl they pulled off an armlet off of Medusa that was a golden snake armlet. And then when they went to get it off of Athena's statue, that also had a snake on the circlet or on the pearl. And I'm like, I don't know, make it the jackpot prize of one of the machines that's snake themed, or at least have snake eyes be something in reference to it. But nope, it's just on a random craps table. Is that
roulette?
Yeah, or roulette.
Roulette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, craps is the dice.
You broke the theme and I am upset now.
I will say I liked their version of like the Lotus Hotel and Casino better. Just first of all, I will say I think the soundtrack for the movie slaps. Highway to Hell, good. Poker Face, good. Kesha, good. Yep. I love her. So I will say the soundtrack really slapped, and I like that they like stole the car that to like to get out of there instead of like a cab. It was just like they just stole a fucking car that was on display and just drove it on out of there.
Yeah, a Maserati, nonetheless.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which took away from like the only good thing that I liked about the episode of the Lotus Hotel, which was the driving lesson of the getting yeah. the taxi out of the parking garage. Like that was excellent.
Yeah, that was cute. I don't know. I did like that they were actually like drinking or gambling, or there was actually like things happening in this Vegas casino, and that they actually ate the lotus flowers. Like yeah. they don't eat them in the show, right?
No, they make the argument yeah. that it's being pumped into the air.
So right, this right. is one of the things I think we might have talked about this, you and me, Eli, about the way this movie of like the. This franchise in particular, I think, runs into this problem of like the meta narrativeness of it all, where yes. they're all just recreating stories from myth, right? So they're doing the things. Everything is repetitive, like with Medusa, right? We're looking at her reflection through the mm-hmm. iPod screen,
yep.
which is that's a gag that could have only worked in a very tight window of time.
Yes.
Oh, I did like that. Yeah, that's yeah. good.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, even in 2010, I feel like that was getting a little. Like yeah. him having that iPod was a little antiquated, but that like everything gets recreated. And then the movie is kind of inconsistent with like what they do and do not know about these myths mm-hmm. because like Grover at one point says, right, he's like, oh my God, we're in Medusa's lair. So like we know the rules of Medusa that we got to follow so we can recreate the story. But the Lotus Eaters are like, it's only after the fact, but they're like, they don't know the rules of the Lotus Eaters. And then later they realize it. And then so there's this like this weird tension of like sometimes they are armed with pre-knowledge and sometimes they aren't. And I think even just in the series broadly, this is kind of a weird little aspect that I haven't fully formed my thoughts on about like it is odd that everything is just so repetitive, right? We're just recreating a lot of things, sometimes like almost exactly, sometimes not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the Hydra, too, was like that, because, like, Annabeth has this knowledge that if you cut off its head, more will grow. But, like, Percy and Grover don't seem to, like, Percy cuts the heads off, like, you know, just flying around. But
that was also very Disney, too.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, reminiscent a lot of the Disney's Hercules and yeah. just being like, oh, I defeated it. And I'm like, no, it's like,
what's a monster that people will kind of recognize? Oh, if they've mm-hmm. seen Hercules, they know the Hydra. And so, like, the audience has maybe this preconceived notion coming into it. We kind of know how this story ends, how this myth goes. And so maybe it's more fun to be able to point and say, I get it. I know what's going to happen.
It was interesting, too, because that Hydra breathed fire,
mm-hmm.
which is not what the Hydra does, but it's what the Chimera does.
And it's whatever. I don't care. They can all be, it's a dragon. It breathes fire. Who cares?
I mean, yeah, exactly. But like that was interesting to me. It was like that was a very drastic change of like doing the St. Louis Arch.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like I thought it was actually a really smart choice to go to the Parthenon in Nashville as like a monument treasure hunt.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I wonder if the permits for filming were cheaper.
maybe Disney pulled it off.
Well, that's Disney.
Well, yeah. Also, I mean, well, we'll say in Disney, they only went to St. Louis for a little bit. Most of the Disney show was filmed, I think, in British Columbia in a volume. So like they did this for The Mandalorian. I think that was a show that really broke it out. But it's like this giant like wraparound screen that they can project the, you know, all the anything they want. So like, you know, years ago when for CGI effect, you'd have people with, you know, just standing in blue rooms with like, you know, tennis balls on sticks.
Right.
So like the Star Wars prequels are really egregious about this, where if you see any of the behind the scenes footage, they're just in like a giant blue empty room, but they're supposed to be in the like Jedi temple. And the volume is, you know, so this way actually like the actors can like see the environments they're supposed to be in. But it also creates this kind of, it never really feels totally real. Like Hannah was mentioning at the beginning that New York felt real. Well, that's because it looked like they actually did shoot in New York. That looked like the steps of the Met. and the things. And like, so they don't ever have to go to New York. They just recreate some part of New York inside the Volume Theater. But there's always that level of like, you can always kind of tell the artificiality of it always shows through a little bit. Like in the Disney series, you can kind of always tell a lot of the times that they're actually just like on a set in a, you know, computer world rather than on location.
I will say something interesting about the changes made in the movies, I think was meant to overall very much simplify the plot, while the choices made for the Disney series was really try to show how complex the relationship of the gods between themselves and the mortals were. So like, oh, we've got this monster to fight. So we got to fight Medusa. We got to fight the Hydra. And then we got to fight the drugs.
The degenerates in Vegas.
In Vegas, they're high, man. Like Lady Gaga comes on.
The way you said that, I was like, we're fighting drugs now? What has DARE done to this country?
We're going back to the 1990s and the DARE program. And
the war is on.
So I keep giving credit to like what the movie did successfully versus what the series did successfully. And I think what the series did successfully is like it set itself up for future seasons, which the movie did not. Like,
but it has a sequel.
It does have a sequel, but it's like you have no indication of Kronos. It's like Luke is obviously the traitor, and his only motivation is like, I want to be the next Zeus, Kronos. I just want to be the next one to take over Kronos versus like, oh, there's a bigger plot afoot here. And, you know, and then Annabeth shows up and Mom's like, hi, Mom. Mom's like, hey. And, you know, those relationships have been so complicated in the series in a good way. Like, if you want to continue to tell the story, you have to leave some of those threads hanging. And you have to, you know, we didn't even get to see Ares. And, like, Ares was one of my favorite characters in the series. That was, he was so good.
Yeah. It, I mean, to your point, it really just sort of seems like the guiding line behind the movie was just like, let's just simplify as much as we can. Like, I would say Annabeth and Clarice kind of got compressed a little bit, we don't need this character. Let's just synthesize and combine and just make it as efficient as possible, just so we have like, we have the skeleton of a plot and that's all we need. Boom, we're done on a movie. I would like my $226 million now, please.
Well, Clarice is actually in the sequel.
Yeah, she shows. Yeah. Well, they add. So is Kronos. They add that. The funny thing is the Sea of Monsters is like ready to start serializing.
Yeah.
And then all of the America and the rest of the world was like, yeah, no, thank you.
It's like, we've had enough.
Yeah. I mean, in 2012, that it was already like, yeah, this ship is sailing.
And it was so much less believable that they were all 17.
It was in the sequel. It's
it's really hard to sort of have that filter.
Rick did say in his email about Luke, he said in the script Luke has become a sniveling little slime ball.
Yeah.
Accurate. No, I liked series Luke a lot better because he was an actual human being with like motivations and the best type of villain where you kind of understand where they're coming from, and this Luke was just insane and a slime ball.
Mustache twirling, I would
mustache
even say.
Mustache twirling, you might say.
Yeah. Not to keep coming back to the musical, but there's like a song Percy sings. It's like it's called Good Kid, and it's about like, you know, he doesn't try to be a bad kid. He tries to be a good kid. And then there's a Luke does a reprise of it later on, and it's like, it doesn't pay to be a good kid, a good kid, a good son. And honestly, he should have had his like complete own reprise. It was so good. And it just like, it kind of makes me emotional when I listen to it.
So we leave New York. We have a Minotaur. We meet the camp.
Oh, you have a very brief back to the beginning. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm just running through the plot right now, seeing what we missed. Right. We get a very brief refusal of the call because, you know, the script dictates it.
Sure.
We go on our quest. Annabeth and Grover join because reasons.
Yeah, there's no prophecy.
Nope.
No. Yeah. Pearls in. And so in it becomes the quest. Get to Pearls 1, 2, 3. Get to Olympus. Get to the underworld. And
they're always considered Persephone's pearls. Is that correct? Because that was, I thought, what they were called in the series, too.
No.
They're just pearls?
Yeah, they're just magic pearls that Poseidon has a nymph give Percy.
Okay.
So the underworld, I guess, is that where we've talked about a little. Do we have any? Well, I guess Medusa. Do we have anything to add to Medusa other than?
I mean, I don't like Medusa in this instance either, but I found it so much less problematic than what they tried to do with Medusa in the series. But then they did the thing that, like, I was glad they didn't in the series. It's like, oh, her head could come in handy. We should probably hold on to it and throw some glasses on it, stick it in some ice in the
sink. Yeah, it becomes a gag.
Yeah,
it does. It becomes a total gag. And I mean, it's like, that's so problematic, but they didn't, you know, they didn't try to make her character sympathetic. So no. I don't care in the same way that I did with, you know, the outcome of Medusa and her head in the series, which I got really upset. It's like, oh, they just sent her head back in a box. They're like, return to sender. And Gabe just happens upon it versus they have kind of the same plot device in the movie, because you see in the credit scenes, he like breaks into the apartment, and then like Percy leaves a letter on the fridge being like, don't open this for any reason. And like Gabe's like, well, F you, and literally breaks into the fridge. And it's like, okay, now that feels a little bit more of a payoff of like a little bit more of hubris on the part of Gabe desperately wanting a beer and him getting a comeuppance of being turned into stone by Medusa's head. As opposed to, it's like, it felt just so accidental in the Disney series of like, yeah, he's still being kind of a jerk by opening a box that doesn't belong to him, but
yeah, it kind of phrased it as like, oh, maybe he didn't deserve this, and it's kind of like washing their hands of it washes their hands of it. It's like, oh no, our characters would never our characters would and have.
Yeah, so that's about all I have to say with Medusa. Is I cared a lot less about Uma Thurman's Medusa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something I'm kind of just thinking, this movie is a good example as like as a time capsule. And because we talk sometimes about periodization and like, are there like moments in time or history where you can draw a line and like there is a definitive like pre and post this thing. And the series and the movie are really good examples of like periodization in like the Me Too era, right? Or like pre 2017, post 2017. Sure. It's night and day difference over like even the approach or the attempts they try to do. And yeah, like that is the kind of like, in that way, this movie feels very of its time because it has that like, we are, you know, it has that pre Me Too sort of like, we're not even going to think too hard about any of this.
Yeah. We're just going to disguise it with like a trying to be witty joke I used to date your dad.
it's so weird because like in terms of Persephone and what she has to say, in terms of how they actually portray Gabe, it was like, it was so much more realistic in that regard, with Medusa's storyline being completely ignored.
Yeah.
Which that felt very, you know, pre-Me Too. But then the Disney series was just so much more of like the backlash since the Me Too movement of like, we're actually too afraid to come out and say this person or this person is an abuser along those lines. And like, I think that's what I found frustrating, is that I would rather almost have Medusa's storyline be completely ignored in favor of like portraying Gabe more realistically and having Persephone come out and call out her abductor and abuser, than to kind of dance around like only Medusa in the series gets to say like, hey, I suffered abuse, and then be called a liar. Right. And then never have that story be resolved in the end.
That's because they didn't actually care.
Yeah.
It's because it's a terrible movie, Christy.
Well, no, I was thinking the series of like, we are made not to care about Medusa in that case, and she was humanized in the series, which is, to me, is more frustrating.
Oh yeah, that's one of my biggest, that's also one of my biggest gripes, especially like when you put it in perspective of like her head and like how she was used as a weapon in death, and but we don't have any evidence that she actually like sought out people to kill them.
Yeah, that the whole cavern of stones, what's the guy's name? The puppeteer clay master guy who did
Ray Harryhausen?
Yeah, Ray Harryhausen. He created that whole motif of like Medusa is this vicious looking half woman, half snake with a darkened cavern full of statues that she had just turned people into stone over time versus yeah, if you read any of the original sources, there's no indication that, like, yeah, Medusa had this power. There's no indication she ever used it.
Mm-hmm. Listen, she just didn't stand your ground state.
Well, there is. In Lucan, there's a part where it describes the lair around her, and it basically describes everything surrounding Medusa's lair as like a petrified forest of like animals and people and plants and things like that.
I don't count Romans. Is he Roman?
Yeah. He's a first century Roman author. It's a whole, it's wrapped into a whole like etiology of Libya and like why there's so many snakes in Libya. And he has a little sort of, he kind of, but his retreading is also kind of a retreading of Ovid's depiction of Medusa's lair, where again, I think the petrified forest thing comes up.
All right. Fine. The Romans fucked it up first, but the Greeks were not saying that stuff. They saying it was like, she has the ability to kill men, but they never say that she does.
I mean, well, in like in archaic art and in Hesiod, she's just like a where she's just one of the Gorgons, which are just monsters. Like they're just kind of stand in kind of boogeymen.
Yeah. And like, even if she's in her lair, like if somebody tries to get in, maybe she turns them to stone, but it's not like she's wandering the countryside looking for people to actively murder.
And the biggest thing that like people forget is like, she was asleep when she was beheaded. She was literally not doing anything to Perseus. She was asleep.
Athena said, I'll be the worst girl boss ever.
She kind of is. Which I versus in the movie. Hey, mom. Hi. Great reunion. The end.
Rick Riordan made like this big deal about like how he wouldn't have any of the actors back from like the original movie because yada yada, he hated it, yada yada. I was watching it, and as Charon comes onto the screen, I'm like, wait a second. I know that gaunt white man. That's Julian Richings, which is he played Procrustes in the series. So they did come back. We did have someone come back. Explained that when Rick.
They didn't tell him.
But also, like, he's awesome. Are you not going to have? Yeah.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, he's one of the great faces.
I don't think so.
Well, as we head to the underworld, one of my favorite Grover moments came into light. I know, like, Colin, you're not, like, a huge fan of Grover, but I liked, as we said, the Will Smith of Grover.
Well, this was one of my great realizations, was that the thing about Grover and his humor and Brandy T. Jackson's appearance, and it, like, clicked in that exact scene where he talks about, like, redecorating the cave or whatever. Yes. I'm like, this is Will Smith in Men in Black in Wild Wild West. That is exactly the energy that he's doing right now. That is sort of what he's channeling.
It's so nostalgic for me, and that's peak Will Smith in my opinion. So
it's like, the scene where he's talking to Edgar's wife, and Will Smith in Men in Black, and he's talking, and he's like, "You should go out, like get a makeover, like get an interior decorator, redo this place, you know." Like that entire interaction in Men in Black is like exactly the interaction that Grover and Charon have in this movie.
Well, here, I got that one for you. So here we go.
Okay, guess not. Look, you like dead people, right? I got a few dead people you might recognize. Check this out. Jackson, Grant, and look who's joining the party. Benjamin Franklin. Yeah, you like that, don't you? Look, you give us a boat ride, you take the money, and you get an interior decorator because it is too depressing in here, all right? There you go.
Climb aboard.
Thanks for telling me, man. You're burning money. We're in a recession. Treason.
We're in a recession. I felt that also.
Yeah, I liked when he was like, Annabeth went out to like, put the guards to sleep or whatever.
Working class Americans.
And I don't know. I kind of like, I like Grover. This is not Grover, I imagine, at all.
Yeah, this is not Grover, but it's a funny character.
I think that was one of our initial complaints about the trio in the Disney series was like it took forever for Grover to like really shine versus like at least this Grover was holding his own. Like you knew who he was in that trio and he was holding that position fairly well as a funny man.
Grover in the series starts out a little bit in the hole because the first things we learn about him is that he's A, 24, and B, has been gaslighting Percy for
and they never years. Yeah, and they never explain why he's 24.
Yeah, it is a weird.
ages differently as a satyr or something.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just I'm 24.
You know, like, I'm actually 24.
Yeah, but he effectively seems the same age as the rest of them. I mean, because in real life, he is the same age as the rest of them. But yeah, that was an odd detail to include. Does that mean when you're a satyr, does that mean you have to be like a tween for like 2 decades?
Kinda, yeah.
Maybe.
Because like,
fuck that.
Yeah.
How would I survive middle school?
I mean, it's like the hardest to believe part of the entire Twilight series is that these 100-year-old immortal children would just keep going back to high school.
Taxes.
Taxes?
Think about it.
If you're a 100-year-old immortal vampire, do you pay taxes?
Yeah, if you're paying taxes, you're doing it wrong.
Right? Because they're acting as the adults. Look at all of those dependents. They get a claim. So we're heading to the underworld, and it's Christian hell.
It's Dante. Let's call it what it is. It's Dante's Inferno.
Fucking Dante.
And the, our Hades is Mick Jagger wannabe.
Yep.
Which again, they have a comedy trend that actually kind of drives me nuts. Is like, you're doing a thing, and then you also have a character make a joke about the thing. It feels like you're trying to like cash in twice on the same thing, right?
Yeah. Double like derivative, as you said in the original episode.
It's like you can't like do a thing and then try to also earn points by calling out that you're doing the thing. I don't know. It just feels lazy to me. But
that's fair. So and that was one thing I really liked about the Disney series was the underworld. I thought was done really well in terms of how it was representing the underworld and the gray place. And then they replaced Cerberus with hellhounds. And I was very intrigued by that deliberate change to the movie. Like, why do you guys think they chose to actually go with Dante's Inferno version of the underworld instead of the gray place?
Because it's easy and recognizable, right? Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like in this like very shallow washed story, we're going for the low-hanging fruit, right? And this very Christianized version of the underworld as hell and like evil and bad.
Lost souls, you know, torment, all that stuff.
Is very easily recognizable and people can latch onto that and be like, oh yeah, oh, I get it, without having to do as much background.
Which I think is kind of interesting overall, because I think the reason that I'm very thankful for Percy Jackson is that it drove a ton of interest into Greek mythology again, and that the movies felt no reason to actually hearken back to the Greek mythology. It was so just focused on the teenage story with some ancient Greek motif to it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder, like, I feel like we're like coming up against an impasse, because it's like, I mean, this is maybe a counterproductive effort on our part and goes against the nature of the show, but like, are we just casting about for meaning where there is none, right? Are we looking for some deeper significance where like,
you know, it was just
the most, you know, expedient process for the creators to create this thing? And then like, we can ask these questions, but it's like, we're going to come up empty-handed. And then you know, is this is this Sisyphean, right? Or is this a Tantalus, right? Are we just reaching for a thing that just isn't there?
I don't know. I think it always has merit to like inspect these things closer, even if it's not what they intended. It's still a side effect. Like I just said something about Twilight, like Stephanie Meyer, like perpetuated so many racist stereotypes and you like just used it to like prop up the Quileute tribe. She didn't intend for it to happen. And she definitely just used it as like a quick way to prop up her story and give some exposition, but it still like ended up having meaning.
Well, and I think
go for it.
I was just gonna say in this case too, it's like, as Hannah said at the beginning, it's like she got introduced to the books via the movie, and then I'm not putting words in your mouth, but it's like I'm sure that drove your interest in taking a class with Colin on classical mythology because you read the Percy Jackson books because you saw the movie. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, kind of. I read the Percy Jackson books, and then I bought like textbooks and I read those, and then I consumed like everything about Greek mythology. So
Yeah. So a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah. It was something that it's been around since I was like very young.
And I think that's just kind of, you know, it's what keeps the field alive, right? Classics. When so many people are saying, it's like, what's the point?
That's what keeps archery from dying, actually. Like, mm-hmm. The Hunger Games and the Hawkeye show. Like, I did not do archery before the Hunger Games. Hunger Games made me interested in archery, and it was a dying sport. And now it's a little more alive.
I think Bones and, like, CSI had very similar effects on, like, getting people in those fields that, like, I think you're right, Colin. It's not necessarily, oh, what were the creators intending? That doesn't always matter. It's more of like what ends up being the net effect. And so I guess my question at the end of the day is, are we glad that the Percy Jackson movie happened?
Ugh.
That's I wouldn't go that far.
Well, because I'm thinking that I'm kind of disappointed and sad that the Percy Jackson movie is maybe what turns people into mythology. Like, great that they do, you know, have this greater interest, and maybe some people, you know, go on to go further in that interest, maybe, you know, major in history or even classics or take ancient languages. But, like, is this how we want classics to be represented in pop culture? Is this, like, our best case scenario? And I hope that it's not.
Is Percy Jackson the equivalent of Ancient Aliens in getting people interested in archaeology?
Oh, Jesus Christ, Christy.
That seems to be, like, if that's the equation, that's like, bleak, that's what that's you're equating in your mind, it's like, that's a legit question. It's like, would I rather?
Yeah.
Ancient aliens not exist, yes. And, like, maybe not have an influx of people interested in archaeology because they watched it, while how many people have watched that and then just taken it as, like, the gospel truth?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, what if that's your only exposure to classics or mythology, and that's your only concept of this story, is this shallow, low-hanging fruit, lazy storytelling? And that's then all that you have.
Yeah.
And that makes me sad.
Would it be inappropriate to say womp womp right now?
Yeah.
I'm the anchor, right? I'm the downer.
I mean, well, I would just say it's a bad movie. And so, like, I mean, independent of whether or not it's, you know, doing anything for the field or, you know, we'll see. I mean, maybe it is. I'm not sure it is, because I don't know if there's necessarily been a influx in, say, classics majors or academics or, you know, maybe casual interest in mythology. But, like, the thing is, like, I don't know if, like, Greek mythology is at risk of anything. Like, it's not going anywhere, as far as I can tell. Like, and if anything, it's growing. And, like, I'm not, like, worried for this day. Like, I don't think it's going to become, like, a lost art or anything like that. The knowledge is there. We don't seem in danger of losing it. And so, like, for that, I'm like, this is just kind of, like, at the end of the day, I'm like, it's just kind of a crappy movie.
It's a terrible movie.
Like, when Percy finds out his mom, like, he thinks his mom died, and he's like, oh, man, no. It wasn't a dream. Like he missed his fucking homework assignment.
She sacrificed so much for me, and now she's gone.
Yeah. It does read like he, like, you know, he, the way, like, that's his reaction is the same reaction that you have when you wake up and you're like, I didn't do that thing I thought I dreamed I did that thing last night. And they're like, no, your friends are like, no, you actually did that thing. And you're like, damn. yeah, it like, I come back to my first point where, like, it just feels like paint by numbers, where it was just like, mm-hmm. checkbox, 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 movie done, money please.
Money please. Mm-hmm.
I will say, I think it would be smart for the Disney series going forward to just do a slight acknowledgement of the movies in, like, funny ways, like parody it, like Ember Island Players and Avatar, or the play from Thor Love and Thunder with Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, I have such complicated feelings about Thor Love and Thunder.
Oh, we did too, trust me.
I almost kind of don't, because, like, I in some ways I have real mixed feelings about this, because, like, the entire sort of field of literature that I work in is deeply intertextual and meta aware, and a lot of it only makes sense if you can kind of tie these threads to points A, B, and C. But I also dread that pop culture is becoming increasingly meta textual all the time. And I was thinking about this as I was watching the movie, of, like, you know, to its credit, this movie at least sort of assumes no prior knowledge on its readers' parts generally. And I feel like that's becoming increasingly rare in our modern media landscape of you can't make sense of the thing unless you've seen the other thing or played or read the other thing. And everything is, you're creating this media web, and there's less and less space for just like a movie to like come out and like be a movie.
No, that makes sense. And I've seen that be complaints with like, you know, the certain video game franchises where now like you have to go on the creator's website, you have to read the book series that comes out, and like
motherfucking Final Fantasy 15 is like predicated on you having like watched an anime series and an entire movie to get any of the backstory for any of the characters or like understand the world.
Five Nights at Freddy's has like 8 games, 15 books.
There are books.
And then the movie, which was very popular, but it was probably very popular for the people who are deeply engrossed in all aspects of that world. And I think that was the biggest takeaway that Colin and Lige, when I listened to your guys' episode the first time you did that, is like, there's so many plot holes. Like, why is this? Why is this? Why is this? That I think even this movie probably needed some more context. And I think the problem with the Disney series is like it tried so hard to give you all of the context you would need if you haven't read the books that you lose some of the joy, right? Like there's not a lot of time for jokes. There's not a lot of time for moments between the trio to actually like build a relationship between each other. And I think that's a really hard balance to strike right now. And in the way that, as Colin says, is like our pop culture is so meta right now.
I'm so exhausted by this movie.
I gotta say, the one main takeaway, the thing that I cannot get out of my head anytime I see this movie or any parts of it. So this most egregious with Percy, but anytime anyone ever wears a backpack, they can only ever have one strap on the backpack in a way. And you can see he's always adjusting it. It's always slipping out, falling out. He can never, and it is like, when did 21 Jump Street come out? Because they made a joke about this. Two years later, 21 Jump Street is going to make a joke about exactly this, where the Channing Tatum character is like, basically it's like, you got to one strap it, bro. Like only lose, like the cool kids always have one strap, like all the time. And then this movie like plays into that. And it just is like, I can't unsee it. I'm like, Percy, wear your fucking backpack. put it on. You're running around. You have like, just put both arms through both loops, man. Go back, rewatch the movie. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, gosh.
I'm never watching this movie ever again.
You say that now, but we said that 4 years ago, and here we are. This movie is rivaled only maybe by Phantom Menace for the disparity between my opinion of this movie and the number of times I've seen it.
Right, yep.
And how much I know about it and have thought about it.
The time that it takes up in my brain.
Yeah, the amount of hours I've spent, I have now spent at least 12 hours of my life, waking hours, watching Percy Jackson and the Olympians, the Lightning Thief.
But at the end of the day, I still haven't seen the second movie.
No.
It's not better.
It's really not.
It's in fact,
even arguably, with Nathan Fillion in it.
Okay, Nathan Fillion does kill it.
He has a fun little cameo. There's the general sort of quality of actors and names they get, there's a precipitous drop off. So like they replace Pierce Brosnan with what's his name from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Rupert. I want to say he's Anthony Head. Rupert's his name in Buffy. David Bort. Oh no, that I'm sorry. No, I'm looking at the cast of Angel, thinking it was a cast of Percy Jackson. I'm like, David Boreanaz wasn't in Percy Jackson. I mean, even with a lot of the actors they had in this movie, it did kind of feel like they were probably like, I would bet Sean Bean was on set for maybe like 3 days.
I did enjoy like when they had like the big godly forms. That was fun.
I hate it. I think it looks so dumb.
It reminded me of the original, Jason and the Argonauts, and like how they're all up on Mount Olympus with the smoke and they're playing with the chairs.
Yeah.
It's very reminiscent of that.
Maybe it's just, you know, not all special effects age equally well, but this movie, this time I was watching it, maybe it was my TV, maybe it was Disney Plus, maybe it was the dating, but like it looked not great. Like when Poseidon comes out of the water in the very first shot, I'm like, this isn't looking good.
Mm-mm. No, it doesn't look great.
Or when you have the superimposition of the giant gods and the little people, it looks very
that bit, like, I like, almost yeah.
Ray Harryhausen almost did it better, like, you know, 80 years ago.
I think that's part of why I think it looks so dumb, is it's like you can just tell it's that weird layering, and I hate it.
Still waiting for someone to figure out how to depict gods in a way, Greek gods in a way in live action that just doesn't. It's like either you make them really big or you plaster them in gold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like the way, this is getting like so far off topic, but I like the way that Troy Fall of a City did their gods.
Yes.
As like mostly human looking, but like in kind of terrifying situations, they would kind of show up. And sometimes, you know, they couldn't be seen and sometimes they could. And I liked how. Yeah.
Artemis had all of one appearance.
And she was terrifying.
It was excellent. I was so upset that was her only appearance, but it was well done.
I know, it was really well done.
I was trying to think of a very like 2010s question or something like that. Like, were we to recast this movie in the year 2010, right? Who would be?
No. Because I can't remember names to begin with, Colin. Those are always hard questions.
Christy, this is a movie podcast.
You hear me saying the names of actors? The majority. I literally called Poseidon Lucius Varenus because that's how I know him.
We got to give credit where credit is due. We got to name the actors. That's like,
you know what? They are so good at their job that I remember them as their characters. That is how good they are. That is how I remember them.
So true, Queen.
Oh, okay. I have the question. If you had to watch 3 times in a row, which one would you prefer to watch? This movie or High School Musical?
The first one?
The first one.
If you had said the second one, you would have had me.
Maybe this, because then I wouldn't have songs stuck in my head. And if I do, it's just like Lady Gaga, and that's fine.
That's fine. I already have We're All in This Together stuck in my head, having asked the question.
Yeah, no.
Colin, what would you find more torture?
I mean, at some level, I've already answered this question because I have watched Percy Jackson and the Olympians, colon, the Lightning Thief 3 fucking times.
But in I've only
seen High School Musical maybe like, I maybe seen like 60% of it maybe. Like,
oh gosh.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. So you don't even know the poison you might be drinking.
This is part, yeah, this is like, I know one devil all too well and the other I don't know. And it's just the real conundrum is like, do I drink the poison that I already know how it tastes? Or do I drink the untasted poison? God.
Might as well try something new.
I guess.
That's such a positive way to think about it. And I feel so cynical. Like, God, no.
Is it? I, this whole thing, I'm like bummed out and angry now. I don't know.
I know. It's all my fault. This is the energy that I know.
You're harshing my vibe. I had enjoyed it. I'm like, this was just the right amount of campy for me.
We're both having like alternate trips right now, right?
Yes.
We're like,
yes.
Like, I'm having a bad trip.
All right. Thank you to our listeners. If you want to learn more about us, you can find us on most major streaming platforms as well as moviesweedig.com. Please write, like, review, and subscribe if you like what you hear. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky under some variation of the handle at moviesweedig. And, support us on Ko-fi. We're going to be moving on from Percy Jackson, y'all, and we're excited because thank now God. We're going to go to the deeply manly show that is Spartacus.
Oh God, is this even worse? Yes.
Colon, blood and sand.
Blood and sand. So hope you guys join us for that. We will talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.